with you.
Good morning. First of all, welcome to all of you to this second day of the conference, and also welcome to those people that are connected telematically to the conference, and they will have not only the possibility to hear everything we can discuss here, but they also have the possibility to ask questions to our presenters. Okay, for me, it is a big pleasure to introduce you our first speaker, Janice Barton. It's a person that I have met in several occasions in the past. I had the opportunity to receive her in Seville, visiting our spin-off company. Janice is professor of experimental mechanics in the Bristol Composite Institute at the University of Bristol, and she is the director of the Industrial Doctorate Center in Composite Manufacturing. She's the author of many, more than 400 papers, and I'm sure that with this title that will appear in a moment, we will be delighted in attending what you have to say.
Thank you very much, Federico. And yes, and there's the title of my paper, Full Field Data Fusion to Characterize Subsurface Defects in Composite Structures. And before I start, I think it's appropriate to acknowledge my co-authors, Irene Jimenez-Fortunado, excuse the pronunciation. Irene is actually from Catalonia. She graduated with her PhD a couple of years ago, and she started this work following some ideas I had. And then the person who's picking up on her work is Rafa Ruiz Iglesias. He's not from Catalonia, he's from Madrid, but I thought it was highly appropriate to have the two main people who've done the hard work, the experimental work and the analysis, coming from Spain whilst doing a keynote at a conference in Spain. And then I thank Emily Lung, who is a PhD student. She did a poster presentation here yesterday, and I'm just going to capture a few key points from her presentation as well. And then Dr. Geir Olafsson, who co-supervised Rafa, and Professor Oli Tibu Thompson, my long-term co-worker and partner in life, who's in the audience today. Thanks also to the organising committee for inviting me here today. It's been a great pleasure to come along, and there's been some wonderful hospitality already, and there'll be some more wonderful hospitality later on. So the work that I'm presenting here is part of a larger project called Certification for Design, Reshaping the Testing Pyramid. And it's funded by EPSRC. It's a program grant, and Bristol are the lead partner in that program grant. So now moving on to the next slide, I'll tell you a little bit, just a snapshot of what CERTEST is all about. Basically, it's about reshaping this so-called testing pyramid to get rid of many of the tests at the bottom end of the pyramid, move things into the virtual space, which I'm not going to talk about today, but concentrate on the middle part of the pyramid, where many of the structural features are captured. And I'm leading Research Challenge 3, which you can see at the top of the Venn diagram, data-rich, high-fidelity structural characterizations. And the topic of the presentation today focuses on a small part of Research Challenge 3, and that's being able to evaluate damage in composite substructures to provide an in-situ measure of subsurface damage in large-scale tests. So what we're going to do is we're going to use heat transfer and thermoelastic stress analysis to pick up and characterize subsurface defects as they're happening. That's the overall target. And what I'm going to show today are the first steps towards that goal and the progress that we've made. So, this is what's going to be in my presentation. I'm going to introduce thermoelastic stress analysis briefly. I'm going to show you how we combine thermoelastic stress analysis with DIC and applied this to carbon fiber composites. I'm going to show you how we identified non-adiabatic behavior, which has been thus far seen as detrimental and one of the difficulties of thermoelastic stress analysis. I'm going to show you how that can be used in a positive sense. And then some steps towards quantifying damage using this technique, and then a few notes on progressing up the scale, the application to sandwich structures, and then to some aerostructure, and then to a larger multi-axial test. So there's a lot to get through. But I'm going to keep to time, I promise, Mr. Chairman. So, hopefully I can get this video going here. So this is what happens in thermoelastic stress analysis. You apply cyclic load to a structure and you capture images with an infrared camera. And here's the loading happening, the cyclic loading, and along with the cyclic loading there's a small temperature change, and that's the thermoelastic effect. And what we can do is we can fit to that infrared signature, because we're capturing lots of images, we can fit the equation shown there to the image frames. And we can extract the mean temperature from that, and we can extract the change in temperature. And we can also extract the phase relative to the input load signal. And the change in temperature, importantly, is related to the principal stresses, sigma 1 and sigma 2. In composite materials, that's coupled with the coefficients of thermal expansion, alpha 1 and alpha 2. And then on the outside there, we have 1 over the density times the specific heat at constant pressure. So this approach assumes, this equation, the equation in red there, assumes that there's no heat transfer and the temperature change occurs adiabatically. And the cyclic loading reduces the diffusion, and application of that curve fit to extract those parameters is a lock-in notch filter. So that means this small temperature change is easily distinguishable, because we lock into the loading frequency that is applied. So the next step in our plan is to combine thermoelastic stress analysis, because it's a stress metric, with digital image correlation to get a relationship between, or to get a connection between the stress, the measured stress from the TSA and the strains from the DIC. So that's basically the loading setup that we're looking at. This is a plan view, if you like, of the test machine, and you can see the infrared camera, and you can see the cameras used for the DIC, and all of that's hooked up to the test machine controller. So thus far, mainly DIC has been used to obtain data for sort of quasi-static loading scenarios. And we've done some work on how to make it useful in cyclic loading. So if you can imagine, we're capturing our IR images very rapidly. If we wanted to apply DIC and make it equivalent to the measurement that you get from TSA, the loads, you would have to capture the white light images at exactly the peaks in the cycle. But there's a problem with that. That means that you can trigger, but that's difficult. So we use the TSA lock-in processing again on the processed strain data to allow us to bring together the two techniques. And if you're interested, that work was published in Optics and Lasers in Engineering several years ago, and we call this just simply lock-in DIC. So the next thing now is to think about how thermoelastic stress analysis works with a typical composite laminar. And I'm showing here a typical composite laminar, and I've shown that there are, in TSA, there are certain things you need to consider, particularly when you're thinking about the heat transfer. So most composite laminates have a resin-rich surface layer, and if we take a look at the resin-rich surface layer on the mould side, you can see that this isn't a glass fibre composite, by the way. You can see the dotty bit at the top is just where it's been potted, but you can see that rich layer of resin. If you look on the bag side where you've got peel ply, that becomes much thicker. So you can see if this is epoxy resin, which has a low thermal conductivity, this may be cause some issues in thermoelastic stress analysis. And we have, the big question was, is the response coming from the orthotropic surface ply, this resin-rich surface layer, or the global laminar? And I'm going to show you that the answer is all, and it all depends. So that's going to be the first part of my my presentation. So what we did is we decided to make some laminates of a certain nature. This is just cross-ply. It has the same mechanical behaviour. One has the 0 ply on the top, one has the 90 ply on the top. And we did a shear dominated plus minus 45. So what we did is we used the simultaneous use of our full field imaging techniques, and from our thermoelastic stress analysis we got, if you like, a measured quantity of delta T over T naught, the thermoelastic response. And then we used digital image correlation, and we took all the material properties, measured material properties, and we were able to back out a theoretical delta T over T naught for the situations that you can see there, the response coming from the resin-rich surface layer, the resin-rich surface layer, the orthotropic surface layer, and the global laminate. And we made our specimens from glass fibre and carbon fibre epoxy. So now if we look at the heat transfer situation in each of these laminate types. So what we've done is we've calculated the delta T, knowing the material properties, and for a given constant strain to compare what is going on ply by ply. So on that table I'm showing the response in the 0 ply, the 90 ply, the plus minus 45, it's going to be the same, the resin-rich surface layer and the overall global laminate. Why is this important? So we can write down our thermoelastic response in a different way, where we include the heat transfer term, which is Q dot, shown in this equation on the right hand side. And Q dot has all of the heat transfer aspects bundled into it, but in this case it's dominated by the thermal conductivity shown by the equation on the right hand side there. So the interesting thing is if you look to the first term on the right-hand side of the first equation, you can see there's a dotted term, epsilon ij. That's the strain, that's the rate of change of strain with time. So if you load at higher frequencies, you can see that your time interval's going down, so that so that term starts to dominate. So if you're at high loading frequency, you can assume adiabatic conditions. And that's been the sort of perceived wisdom for many, many years in metals, okay? And it works in isotropic materials. But now let's start looking at our orthotropic laminated composites. So if we look first of all at our GFRP, you can see that delta T in that material is about the same. This means that the thermal, and also the thermal conductivity is low, but there's little change in delta T between the plies. So second law of thermodynamics says you're in an equilibrium situation. There can be no heat transfer, so you get adiabatic conditions. So you can kill off that term. Everything's fine. If we look conversely at carbon fibre, we have carbon fibre with high thermal conductivity. There's a massive step change in delta T at the interface, so there's something to drive the heat transfer. So we get non-adiabatic behaviour at low frequencies. And then if we look at the plus minus 45, you can see that the delta T is the same in the plus 45 and the minus 45, no heat transfer. So that goes out. And then you can think of, well, if that we've got a very thick resin-rich layer, then it's working as a strain witness. No heat can be transferred through that because there's a high thermal conductivity. So that term can also go out. There's another situation where we look at the smeared laminate values, the global laminate values. And this would be where there was a lot of heat transfer going on. So the big question is, at the end of that rather long description, is delta T occurring adiabatically? So we conducted tests at different loading frequencies. And I'm just going to focus now on the carbon fibre material, because you can see from the theory that the glass fibre material, there can be no heat transfer. And we showed that that happened. And that was all written up in a paper that was published in Composites Part A. And what I'm showing you is a snippet of the results from that paper for the carbon fibre materials. And you can see in the carbon fibre materials so I'm plotting loading frequency against delta T over T naught against the loading frequency. And you can see for the three different scenarios of the 0-90, the 90-0, and the plus minus 45, you can see that there's a different response. So the black dots are from Irena's paper that was published. And then Rafa, when he came along, we did a very dangerous thing. I said, repeat Irene's experiments. And he did. And miraculously, because sometimes when you repeat experiments, you don't get the same results out. But this time, the results came out identically, and he's done many more stages along the process. So we felt very happy with this, and we could say that what you're seeing in the left-hand side there is the global laminate response, and on the right-hand side, the surface ply response, and in the plus minus 45, it's all the surface ply response. So you think, that's interesting. So I'm just going to plot now a few of those results from that work and the full field data. And you can see, so the points on these graphs, by the way, is spatially averaged. But I'm now showing this very rich full field data from the TSA. And you can see that we're moving from the global laminate response to the surface ply response in both those cases. So the next question was, what happens if you put in an off-axis ply or some off-axis plies? Do you get the same results? So this is for a 0.45, minus 45, 0.00 symmetrical laminate. And you can see there's some interesting results going on, some different types of heat transfer. But heading towards what looks like the surface ply response. And then if you put those 45 plies even deeper, then you can see there's something else going on, that you're getting a combination of not just the surface ply response, but also now you're feeling in these results something happening as a result of that resin-rich surface layer. So if you look in the literature, you'll find that there are many different theories about where the surface, where the thermoelastic response comes from in these laminated materials. And some people say the surface ply, some people say the global laminate, some people say the resin-rich surface layer. And there's a very nice review of that in the paper that I just showed you where you can see. And you start thinking, well, that, you know, everybody can't be right. But actually, this is showing that everybody is right because it is highly dependent on the layup in CFRP. And when I say layup, I don't just mean the stacking sequence. I mean the thickness of the plies, the thickness of the surface-rich resin layer. So, you know, is there anything useful you can do with this? So we started thinking that we could, if we fuse the DIC data with the TSA data, we might be able to extract some way or another some information about damage occurring in subsurface plies. So the next part of the work that I'm showing you, it's all work in progress and some interesting results. So this is our full field data fusion approach. We take the DIC and the TSA. We then extract the different models, in this case the surface ply model, to the DIC data, and we subtract that from the TSA. So this gives us this opportunity to identify damage. So the next job is to put the damage into these specimens. So there are our strip specimens loaded in tension. And what we did is we increased the load. So we got above first ply failure all the way to full failure. And we looked at a range of different frequencies. So now I'm going to talk about the inspection methodology. So we used two approaches. The first methodology was with DIC. So we take the DIC calculated thermoelastic response, which has to be representative of adiabatic behavior because it doesn't feel the heat transfer in the same way, it's just kinematic. I take that away from the TSA, and then what's left is an indication of what's going on in the subsurface. And then methodology number two, because we can load up to quite high frequencies here, we take the TSA data at high frequency away from the TSA data at low frequencies. So one of the backsides of doing the DIC is you have to interpolate, and that introduces a potential interpolation bias. And with the TSA data, that's not the same. But you have to assume that adiabatic conditions have been achieved. So how do we actually identify these adiabatic conditions have been achieved? Well, once again, I'm showing again the slide where we load over many frequencies. And then we take our TSA data and we look at our DIC data. We take one away from the other and we get a residual. And then we can see that if we are in adiabatic conditions, if you take the DIC away from the TSA data, then at that loading frequency, you are in an adiabatic situation, and you can see there that the mean is just around about zero in these plots. So the frequency for the adiabatic behavior is identified by fusing the TSA data with the surface ply response model from the DIC. And we did this for all of our laminates. And we can see with the cross plies, we've got adiabatic behaviour at about 20 hertz. There's a much bigger spread on that data, and we're not quite sure why that is. And for the CFRP, we've got adiabatic behaviour occurring at 30 hertz, and we've got a smeared laminate response at 3.1 hertz for the for the cross ply, and at 0.5 hertz for the off-axis, the laminates containing the off-axis plies. So when we apply our subsurface damage analysis methodology, we're going to apply methodology one, where we take away the DIC data from the TSA, and methodology two, where we've taken away the TSA data at high frequency from the TSA data at low frequencies. So we're just going to pause and go slowly through all of this. So after first ply failure, so you can see the 52% of the ultimate tensile strengths, we are seeing various different areas of damage in this. And then we can see subsurface defects start to be visible after the first ply failure. And then we can see more subsurface features are seen in methodology one. And methodology two, interestingly, shows a decrease in the thermoelastic response. Different. They should, in theory, be the same. I'm going to ask you to have a think about why you think that might be different. We think we know the answer, and maybe that could be the first question in the question session. And we do the same with the plus minus 45, with the off-axis plies, and you can see that the subsurface responses observed in methodology one and methodology two shows a similar subsurface response and some possible delaminations. And then if we look with the 45s deeper in, you can see once again the subsurface response is observed in methodology one, and then wrinkles are observed as well, which is interesting, not shown in methodology two, but not methodology one. And then possible delaminations again in methodology two. So this shows the spatial richness of this data, and it exploits the spatial richness. So the previous data I've shown, we've averaged they've taken the spatial average of the data, and we haven't done that here. But instead, because you're going to lose that richness, and we're not quite sure how to take this further. But something that was done many years ago was, back in the 1990s, was some work using the old SPATE system, where a damage parameter was defined, and we took the opportunity to look at this again. And so basically, now we're looking, the X's and the Y's here signify the laminate and not the plies. And we can put together a theory where we look at the stress, the global stress in the laminate, and the thermoelastic constant K in the undamaged situation to derive a damage parameter D that you can see there. So the K undamaged is alpha X over rho CP, and we can extract that experimentally from an undamaged strip specimen. So we have our damage parameter, and in the undamaged state, the damage parameter is zero, and in the damaged state, it's non-zero. So that's our damage parameter. We can also use the DIC to come up with a parameter based on the stiffness reduction. So here it's the So here it's the laminate stiffness, the assumed laminates, the equivalent laminate stiffness. And the question we could ask now, does the DTSA give a better quantification of damage than using this typical stiffness reduction approach? So the data processing steps exactly the same as before. We get we fuse the data together, and then we apply the damage parameter. So I'm going to quickly go through this because the chairman has stood up. And now you can see I'm plotting the damage parameters for the 0 and the 90, and the 90 and the 0 specimens, and you can see the DTSA and the D from the Young's modulus, and you can see that the damage parameters are higher for the thermoelastic approach than this damage quantification. And then when we increase the load and we've damaged the specimen even more, you can see that this damage parameter once again is going up for the TSA, but is low for the Young's modulus. So this is an interesting observation. And just to summarize this interesting observation, I've done this overview, which shows you the order in which the damage parameter is greater. So it's the greatest for the 90 naught, then the 45s, and then the 0-90, and then the one with the off-axis plies deeper in. And we can see that this is interesting, but not quite right, because this is telling you that the damage in the damage in one should equal the damage in three, right? Now there might be some constrained layer effects happening in the one in position three, but if you look at the 45s, that's not the case, and we know that the level of damage must be the same because the layups contain the same number of 45s. So this requires some further work to interpret, but it is actually showing that you're picking up damage from the subsurface. So just very quickly, I'm going to talk about moving up the scale to sandwich structures, and this is the work that Emily showed yesterday, and you can see with this front-coated mirror we can observe damages happening in the sandwich structure, and here are some of the data that we've got from by exploiting the non-adiabatic behavior. Also looking at the phase of the response, and looking at the differences between going across a defect. So this defect is buried. So this allows us to start saying, well, we can actually look inside a large sandwich structure and observe the damage. What we want to do is to quantify that damage, and we've started working on that, and we're fusing the TSA and the DIC. We're also scaling up to an aerostructure C-spar, which you can see here in the test machine with the speckle on, and there's Rafa doing the tests. And this is very much work in progress. Here is our C-spar loaded in compression. This is in the undamaged state. It contained lots of wrinkles and so on. Then we cranked up the load, put some damage in, and then reduced the load to do the TSA. And you can see in the one on the left-hand side, you can see that the corners, they have wrinkles. This is an area of large stress concentration. And interestingly, on the right-hand side, you can see that there has been perhaps some stress relief because the thermoelastic response has gone down. And we know by looking at this, there's a crack in that corner. So that's work in progress. The second bit of work in progress is looking at multi-axial loading of wind turbine blade substructures. So here we're loading our wind turbine, section of our wind turbine blade with a realistic load. We're able to capture the bending moment that's applied at the center of that of the web. And we're building a loading rig, or we've built a loading rig to apply the load and the pin connection there, which allows that moment to that rotation to accommodate that moment. And there is the rig, and that's going to be the object of further reports at conferences. Certainly if you go to ICCM, you'll hear a lot about this rig and the CERTES project as well. So that brings me to my last slide and some conclusions. I hope you found the talk interesting, and I was asked by a reviewer of a paper on this, is anybody in industry interested in all this stuff? And I was able to say, well, yes, because our CERTES project is sponsored by various different industries, and it's a collaboration between Bristol, Bath, Southampton and Exeter as well. So that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much, and sorry for overrunning slightly.
Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. We have time, with the permission of the next chairman, a couple of minutes. Any question for Professor Barton? Yes, please, Fabrice.
Thanks, Janis. Very, very nice presentation. I had a question about what happens to the coefficient of thermal expansion when you start having damage. Presumably, they will change.
That's a very good question, Fabrice. Yes, it does change. And that's something that we are starting to put into a damaged model that we're improving upon. And that work's actually been written up and is just about to, hopefully, it's been accepted, subject to some corrections which have been done. And we are able to put into this damage parameter, or expand that damage parameter to include these changes in coefficient of thermal expansion. The other interesting thing, of course, that happens is that in those off-axis plies, as you're pulling, you actually move the 45s more into the naught direction, so you also get stiffness change as well. So you get a counterintuitive result where it seems that your damaged structure is getting stiffer because you've got reorientation as
and
well.
And a similar question for the when you subtract the DIC data, so you need to change your strains into stresses, and again you need a modulus, and what happens when it's damaged? Do you take that into account?
Not yet, no.
Thank you. Any other comment or question? So in this case, thank you very much again.